Good morning. If I can have your attention, please. My name is Michael Potts, and I'm CEO and president of the Rocky Mountain Institute. We're based here in Colorado, and we're dedicated to the efficient and restorative use of resources. It is my pleasure to introduce our chairman and chief scientist and co-founder, Amory Lovins. Amory is the author of 29 books. He is the winner of the Blue Planet, Shingo, Nissan, Volvo, and MacArthur Awards, among many others. He has received 11 honorary doctorates and is the strategic leader of our institute, which is really working hard to help transform our world from our current dependence on fossil fuels to a cleaner, safer, brighter world fueled by efficiency and renewables. Please join me in welcoming Amory Lovins.
Thanks. Thank you, Michael. Imagine fuel without fear. No climate change. No oil spills, dead coal miners, dirty air, devastated land, lost wildlife. No energy poverty. No oil-fed wars, tyrannies, terrorists. No leaking nuclear wastes or spreading nuclear weapons. Nothing to run out. Nothing to cut off. Nothing to worry about. Just energy abundance, benign and affordable, for all, forever. That richer, fairer, cooler, safer world is now possible, practical, even profitable. Because now, saving and replacing fossil fuels works better and costs less than buying and burning them.
So, thank you, and thanks to some of our National Solutions Council members and donors who are here or making this work possible, for the honor of helping you imagine this morning a world where business leaders and civil society, ahead of most governments, have abandoned oil, coal, and nuclear energy in favor of alternatives that work better and cost less, namely efficiency and renewable energy. This could solve many of the world's biggest problems without making new ones. Next spring, my team will complete and publish a detailed synthesis of that world and how to get there by vividly describing what exists, what works, what makes sense and makes money. We aspire to change the conversation from that's impossible and what'll it cost to here's how and how can we invest. After all, at Rocky Mountain Institute, we do solutions, not problems. We are practitioners, not theorists, and we do transformation, not incrementalism. Now, in politics and in the media, we are often presented with this stupid energy policy multiple choice test, which, if it were clearly stated, would read like this: would you rather die of climate change or oil wars or perhaps nuclear holocaust? Of course, a better answer, which we are seldom offered, is none of the above, and that's what we get when we use energy in a way that saves money, because then climate change, oil dependence, nuclear proliferation all go away, not at a cost, but at a profit, because saving fuel costs less than buying fuel. Somehow, most of the Copenhagen negotiators forgot that efficiency is cheaper than fuel, so they argued about cost, burden, and sacrifice. But they should have been instead discussing profits, jobs, and competitive advantage. This sweetens the politics so much that any remaining resistance to climate protection should melt faster than the glaciers. Now, a year and a half ago, McKinsey and Company showed how to cut projected 2030 global emissions of greenhouse gases by 70% very cheaply. I'm going to outline how using newer technologies and integrative design could save even more at negative cost. But do we have enough time? How fast must energy efficiency work? Well, if the energy used to make a unit of economic activity kept drifting down by just 1% a year, as it did historically, then carbon emissions would triple by 2100, and then we're all toast. But of course, we want to make toast, not be toast. What if we could cut that energy intensity not 1%, but 2% a year? Well, that would be enough to stabilize emissions. And if we could cut energy intensity 3% or 4% a year, that would reduce emissions enough to avoid triggering further climate chaos. But can we do that? Well, yes. Actually, the United States has routinely cut its energy intensity 2% to 4% a year for decades. And when we last paid attention, we cut our oil intensity over 5% a year. China has cut its energy intensity over 5% a year for a quarter century, and after a few years' lapse, has nearly regained that pace. Many big companies are making billions of dollars profit substituting efficiency for fuel and cutting their energy intensity by 6 to 16% a year. So why should 3 or 4% a year be so hard, especially since most of the growth is in countries like China and India that are building their infrastructure the first time and can more easily build it right than fix it later? And since everyone who does energy efficiency makes money at it, why should this be costly? There are two big narratives here, oil and electricity, which is mostly about coal. Oil and power plants each release more than 2/5 of the fossil carbon going into the air in this country and in the world. So let me start with the oil story. 6 years ago, my team published a detailed, transparent, Pentagon co-sponsored study, Winning the Oil Endgame, showing how to eliminate U.S. oil use by the 2040s, led by business for profit, and facilitated by innovative public policy. We wrote it for business and military leaders. We built the argument around competitive strategy business cases for cars, trucks, planes, military, and fuels. And you can download the whole thing free at oilendgame.com, or there are copies out on the table. Now, the solution we found is first to save half the oil by redoubling the efficiency of using it at an average cost, it turned out, of $12 per saved barrel. And then we would substitute saved natural gas and advanced biofuels for the other half at an average cost of $18 a barrel. Well, the average cost then is $15 a barrel to get off oil. That's about 5 times less than what we pay for the stuff right now, assuming its hidden or external costs are all worth zero, a conservatively low estimate. Our costliest barrel of savings or substitution would be $26 oil. So the business case is so powerful that implementation would require no new federal taxes, mandates, subsidies, or laws. Now, the nub of the problem technologically is, of course, transportation. Vehicles use 70% of our oil. But it turns out we can triple the efficiency of cars, trucks, and planes without compromise, but with better safety, just by making them lightweight, more slippery in moving through the air and along the road, and giving them advanced propulsion. This often improves performance as well. For example, in this Opel diesel hybrid concept car, which gets 150 miles an hour and 94 miles a gallon, although not at the same moment. Triple efficiency cars can repay any extra cost in about a year. Triple efficiency trucks, even faster. Triple efficiency planes in a few years. So triple efficiency vehicles are about as cheap as fuel costing 25 to 55 cents a gallon. It's a good deal. These breakthrough vehicles can serve all purposes and tastes. For example, 10 years ago, my team and a couple of European industry partners designed this uncompromised, safe, high-performance, mid-sized suburban assault vehicle. It uses 3.6 times less fuel than its steel equivalent, gets 67 miles a gallon. And it would sell for $2,500 extra, a one-year payback, because it's hybrid electric. But cutting out over half its weight turned out to be free because the costlier carbon fiber got offset by simpler automaking and a smaller propulsion system. More on that in a minute. 3 years ago, Toyota showed a carbon fiber concept car that has the same interior size as a Prius, half the fuel use, and 1/3 the weight. It has a tiny battery bank recharged by a half-liter engine tucked under the rear seat. RMI's fifth for-profit spinoff, Bright Automotive, is ready to mass-produce this aluminum van, which, unlike other plug-in hybrids, needs no subsidy to make a strong business case to the fleet buyer because its lightweight and low drag got rid of most of the costly batteries. The way to make batteries affordable is not to need many of them by getting the obesity out of the car. We call it platform fitness. Now, to understand how to get such big and cheap oil savings, we need to look at the physics of cars. Did you know that every day your car uses about 100 times its own weight in ancient plants? Our advanced industrial economy is fueled largely by burning the rotted remains of primeval swamp goo and dinosaur poop. Surely there's a more modern way. Well, what happens to that gasoline you buy that was skillfully made from that old swamp goo? 7/8 of it never gets to the wheels. It's lost in the engine, idling, driveline, and accessories. Of the 1/8 that reaches the wheels, over half is lost pushing air aside and heating the tires and road, and only the last 6% actually accelerates the car and then heats the brakes when you stop. Oh, it gets worse. Only 1/20 of the mass you're accelerating is you. 1920 is the heavy steel car. So only 1/20 of 6%, or 0.3% of the fuel energy actually moves the driver. But the good news is that 2/3 of the energy it takes to move the car is caused by its weight. And every unit of energy we save at the wheels saves 7 additional units we don't need to waste getting it to the wheels. So altogether, there's huge leverage in making the car radically lighter weight. Every unit of energy saved at the wheel saves a total of 8 units in the tank, whereas if you, say, electrify the car or give it a better engine, there's no leverage. It's only 1-to-1 between the direct savings and what you save at the tank. So you're always better off doing platform fitness first and then paying for most of the light weighting or more by shrinking the propulsion system to get the same acceleration. Now, ultra-light, ultra-safe cars don't need to cost more to build. Here's why. That SUV I showed you a minute ago has only 14 parts in the body, each made with one low-pressure die set that saves about 99% of the, say, $500 million tooling cost. Each part can be lifted with one hand and no hoist. The big part on the side I can briefly lift with one finger. The parts snap precisely together for bonding without needing the robotic body shop. If you lay color in the mold, you don't need the paint shop either. So there go the two hardest and costliest parts of making the car, and capital intensity would be at least 2/5 below the leanest plant in the industry. And then the propulsion system gets 2/3 smaller, hence lighter and cheaper. Now, carbon fiber used to be thought way too expensive for anything but race cars and sporting goods, but now there's new technology. An example here from another of our spinoffs that's down in Glenwood Springs. If we're making carbon fiber parts like this test piece, which you can tell is very strong and stiff, and this was made in just 1 minute. So that sort of process can scale to automotive cost and speed with aerospace performance. By the way, this is also tougher than titanium. I'll pass it around. Don't worry about dropping it. Tom Friedman has whacked it as hard as he can with a sledgehammer without hurting it at all. So this sort of new manufacturing technology is like finding a Saudi Arabia in the Detroit formation. You know, our Wildcatters have been drilling in Detroit. It's a very prospective play. And that's how much oil the U.S. would save, a Saudi Arabia's worth, if we made all our cars and light trucks this way, because then half the weight and half the fuel use go away. The car gets safer because this stuff can absorb 12 times as much crash energy per pound of steel, and it costs the same to make. There are also perfectly valid light metal solutions, aluminum and so on, like the 64-mile-a-gallon hybrid I drive. Now, at RMI, we accelerate these kinds of breakthroughs in oil savings by what we call institutional acupuncture. We figure out where the business logic is congested, not flowing properly. We stick little needles in it to get it flowing. Our partners range from Ford to Walmart, Boeing to the Pentagon. Of course, taking the world beyond oil requires 6 sectors to be transformed: cars, trucks, planes, fuels, military, and finance. In my opinion, at least 3 or 4 of those are around the tipping point where it starts getting easier, although a lot of hard work is still needed. Indeed, last year, mainstream analysts started to see peak oil not in supply, but in demand. In April 2009, the Wall Street Journal reported ExxonMobil was agreeing with many forecasters that U.S. gasoline use had peaked in 2007 and will never get that high again. In September, the top strategic consultancy to the oil industry said that the industrialized country's total oil use had peaked in first quarter 2005 and will never get that high again. And last October, Deutsche Bank, based on electrification of cars, forecast that world oil use will peak around 2016 and then by 2030 fall to about 8% below now or 40% below the consensus forecast. And they assume China will electrify new cars only a third as fast as China's actually planning to do. In short, oil is becoming uncompetitive even at low prices before it becomes unavailable even at high prices. Now, my second big story is about saving electricity and then making it differently. About 70% of our electricity is used in buildings, 30% in industry. 2 decades ago, my team did about a 1,000 technology assessment, finding that about 3/4 of all that electricity is wasted. Since then, efficiency technologies have improved faster than they've been installed. So now the efficiency potential is even bigger and cheaper. But there's an even more important innovation we've developed at RMI called integrative design, which turns diminishing returns into expanding returns to investment in energy efficiency. That is, it can make very large energy savings cost less than small or no savings. For example, 25 minutes down valley from here in Old Snowmass, Judy and I live in this building. It's at 7,100 feet elevation down to the Banana Belt, you know, 900 feet lower than Aspen. But we've still seen temperatures there down to minus 47 F. Midwinter cloud can last 39 days. We've seen frost on the 4th of July. And yet the house is fossil fuel free, combustion free, and net energy exporter, 99% passive solar heated with no conventional heating or cooling equipment. And if you come inside, there's this emerging tropical jungle now ripening the latest of our 35 banana crops. Now, when first completed in 1984, this house was saving about 99% of its space and water heating energy, half the water, 90% of the household electricity, all with a 10-month payback. Today's technologies, which we've just retrofitted, are even better. The key is integrative design that gives multiple benefits from single expenditures. For example, that white arch you can see at the upper left has 12 functions, but only one cost. Hardly any part of the building does fewer than 3 things. But it doesn't have to look like this to work like this, and its design approach works in any climate, including eliminating air conditioning up to at least 115 Fahrenheit with lower construction cost and better comfort. The same approach works also for big buildings, old and new. This retrofit, Empire State Building, is now underway via our partners in industry and the Clinton Climate Initiative. It's expected to save 38% of the energy with a 3-year payback, thanks to integrative design. Remanufacturing the 6,500 windows on site into super windows that are almost perfect in letting in light without heat, plus better lights and office equipment, cuts the peak cooling load by 1/3. And that lets us tunnel through the cost barrier, because now we don't need to block and tear up Fifth Avenue to dig up the old chillers and replace and expand them. Instead, we can renovate them in place and reduce them, and that saves $17-odd million of capital cost that helps pay for the other improvements and cuts the payback to 3 years. If you similarly retrofit a 20-year-old curtain wall office tower near Chicago, one of these all-glass and no-windows towers, we found you could save 3/4 of its energy with a payback of minus 5 months. In other words, slightly cheaper than the routine 20-year renovation you have to do anyway that saves nothing. So why don't we see this approach all over the place? Well, because in conventional practice, the more you save, the more it costs you, diminishing returns. And in conventional thinking, you invest in efficiency, like, say, adding insulation to our house, until the marginal cost equals the cumulative savings and so on. And then you're at the cost effectiveness limit where most people stop. However, if you keep investing beyond that limit, in our case using twice as much insulation as is considered cost effective, you reach a point where suddenly your marginal cost goes down. In our case, we no longer needed the furnace, ducts, fans, pipes, pumps, wires, controls, fuel supply arrangements. So it was $1,100 cheaper not to put in the heating system, but to invest instead in the super insulation, super windows, and so on that got rid of the heating system. So optimizing the building as a system, not the insulation as a component, yields expanding returns to investment in efficiency. Of course, your lowest risk investment is the one you don't need to make. The same approach works great in industry, too. For example, 3/5 of the world's electricity runs motors. Half of that runs pumps and fans. Well, there are 35 things you can do to a typical motor system to save about half its energy. And it's a one-year payback because you only need to pay for the first 7 improvements. The other 28 are then free byproducts. But first, we should stop wasting most of the energy used by the pumps, fans, and other motor-driven equipment. For example, pumps, the biggest use of motors, move liquid through pipes. A Dutch engineer redesigned a typical industrial pumping loop to use at least 86% less pumping energy and cost less to build just by using fat, short, straight pipes instead of skinny, long, crooked pipes. In this design, the Singaporean master engineer Liang Lok, who taught us this stuff, saved 69% of the usual pumping energy and lowered the construction cost. Not rocket science, good Victorian engineering rediscovered. So what do such savings mean for the electricity that is 60% used in motors? Well, from the coal burned in the power plant to the end use, many successive losses compound, so only a tenth of the energy in the coal actually comes out the pipe as flow. But now turn that around backwards, so those compounding losses turn into compounding savings, and every unit of flow or friction you save in the pipes saves 10 units of coal cost pollution and global weirding back at the power plant. Also, as you go back upstream, each component gets smaller, simpler, and cheaper, so you save the most capital cost too. My team has found such snowballing energy savings in more than $30 billion worth of industrial redesigns in 29 diverse sectors. Let me give you a high-tech example from a data center recently completed in Britain for EDS, now Hewlett-Packard. If you feed 100 watts of fuel into the power plant, maybe 30 watts or so of electricity will get delivered to your meter. Most of it's lost as waste heat at the power plant, a little in the grid. Of the 30 watts you pay for, you're lucky if half actually gets into your servers because about half is used in cooling and uninterruptible power supplies, the things that account for half the capital cost of the data center. Of what gets into the server, maybe half gets to the chips because so much is lost in terrible power supplies and 8 or 9 fans to take heat that typically shouldn't be there off the motherboard into the room so we can do dumb things with it. Well, the chips mostly sit there humming away but not doing very much good because of severe underutilization of all the computing resources. So very little actually gets into applications. Now, let me magnify that little stalk because it's about to get so small you can't see it. The next problem is bloatware, inefficient or valueless applications, and after that you might even have inefficient business processes, God forbid. So by the time you get through, very, very little value is being delivered to the customer. But as in the pumping example or the car example, let's start downstream and go backwards to get compounding savings. The first thing you'd want to do is write terse code, elegantly compiled, so that every compute cycle is a needed and wanted one. Next, you could buy servers about 4 times more efficient. They don't even cost more. And then you don't need much cooling and power supply for them, and there are much more efficient ways to do that than the conventional ones. And then you could even get rid of half the utility loss with on-site trigeneration from a fuel cell. At any rate, you get the idea. When you multiply all those savings going back upstream, you can get on the order of 100-fold energy leverage. And in fact, this data center saved about 3/4 of the energy, it's in the lower left, and no extra cost. And they later realized that had the client allowed them to follow all our recommendations, they would have saved about 95% of the energy and half the capital cost. There are lots of other nifty examples. Our latest chip fab design is expected to save 2/3 of the energy and half the capital cost. Our latest mine design is expected to use no fossil fuel and no grid electricity. It runs on gravity, very reliable. But of course, we couldn't do these kinds of redesign if the stuff had been designed right in the first place, and I'm getting pretty impatient with redesigning stuff that wasn't designed right. So we want to go to the root of the problem, which is how engineering is taught and practiced, and to transform that through our Factor 10 engineering project, 10XE. It's a plot for the nonviolent overthrow of bad engineering. And now, I did promise to tell you about the other revolution in electricity. Besides efficiency, there is a little noticed dramatic shift in how the world produces electricity. And that's summarized in this graph of how much electricity is produced worldwide by what The Economist magazine calls micropower. The tan or orange part at the top is cogenerating electricity together with useful heat in factories and buildings. That saves at least half the fuel, energy, carbon, money. And then underneath that, the colored wedges are all renewable sources of electricity other than big hydro plants. And you can see that micropower is growing explosively, while central station orders wither because they cost too much, the coal, nuclear, gas plants, and they have too much financial risk to attract investors. So in 2008, the latest available global data, three remarkable things happened. Micropower made over 17% of the world's total electricity versus 13% for nuclear, and micropower made about 91% of the world's new electricity. Second, for the first time in about a century, all renewables got more global investment than all fossil fuel generation. Third, renewables, excluding big hydro, got $100 billion of private investment and added 40 billion watts, while nuclear power got and added nothing. Here's another look at how dramatically things are shifting. It shows the annual net additions of capacity, wind in blue, photovoltaics in yellow, nuclear in red. And the electrical output of even photovoltaics, the costliest renewable, has been outpacing nuclear growth since '08, and nuclear may never catch up. This micropower revolution is increasingly led by China, which right around now is blowing past its 2020 wind target. So revolution already happened. Sorry if you missed it, but there's still a lot to take part in. Now, we do hear a lot about the nuclear renaissance, so I've been out looking for it. I think I found it. This graph shows the number of reactors in blue and their capacity in red listed as under construction each year since 1950 by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And the nuclear renaissance is this little uptick in the last few years, getting to about 1/4 of the peak construction rate we had in 79. There are now about 61 nuclear units under construction. But if you look a little more closely at them, a curious pattern emerges. 12 of them have been listed under construction for over 20 years. 39 of them have no official startup dates. At least half are late. 44 of them are in 4 centrally planned, not very transparent systems, namely China, India, Russia, and South Korea. Almost all the new starts are in China. All 61 of them were bought by central planners, generally with a draw on the public purse, and none of them was a free market transaction, as we normally understand it, where it gets competed against or compared with its real competitors. Of course, the flip side of this big boom in construction we had in the 70s and 80s is a similar burst of retirements later on. How much later depends on how long you can extend the lifetime consistent with safety and economy of operation. But clearly, with this enormous overhang of retirements about to wash over us, new construction will be hard-pressed just to make up for the retirement of the existing fleet. So what do we do instead about the nearly half coal power that we're generating in this country? Well, if the amount of coal power we're making is one unit on this horizontal axis, here are some of the things we can do about that. Some are cheaper than running an old coal-fired plant. For example, if the United States used electricity as productively as the top 10 states did 5 years ago on average, adjusted for each state's climate and economic mix, that would displace around two-thirds of the coal-fired electricity. And altogether, the profitable efficiency compared with an old coal plant is at least big enough to displace all of the coal-fired electricity, probably more. There's a whole bunch of options that are cheaper than building and running a new coal plant. For example, just the wind power stuck in the interconnection queue would displace nearly half the coal power, and altogether the cost-effective wind power on available land would displace 19 times the coal power. You think we could site a 19th of the profitable wind opportunities? I should think so. And industrial cogeneration is probably good for at least two-fifths of the coal power. There's a lot of potential in building cogeneration. We don't know how much yet. We're figuring that out along with the other renewables. And if we just ran the coal plants less and the existing combined cycle gas plants more, that would displace upwards of a third of the coal power. And that's already starting to happen in the market as coal gets more expensive and gas cheaper. The last category I'll show here is stuff that costs more in conventional measures than building a new coal plant, but it won't by the time you could build the coal plant. And the obvious example is photovoltaics, which could displace the coal power on an annual basis if you put them on 3% of the structures in the United States using no land. So if you add all this up, let's see, that's somewhat over 22 times the coal power. This does not sound like a very difficult problem. We have an embarrassment of riches. There are, of course, a lot of practical issues in doing it, but I think they're probably easier than the business as usual ones. So let me put these transformations in efficient use and diverse, dispersed, renewable supply of electricity into a bigger context, because together they're starting to flip the whole power sector on its head. Traditionally, electric companies relied mainly on giant coal and nuclear plants that respectively cause climate chaos and spread nuclear bombs. And then we augmented those with giant gas plants and bought a little bit of efficiency and renewables. Those utilities were rewarded, as in most of the world and most of the United States, including this state, for selling more electricity. But now, especially where regulators are starting instead to reward cutting customers' bills, the market is shifting massively towards efficiency, renewables, combined heat and power, and other new ways to blend them all together reliably so the lights stay on with little or no need for bulk electricity storage. Now, these best buys turn out to save 2 to 20 times more carbon per dollar and 20 to 40 times more carbon per year than nuclear power, so the verdict of the marketplace is also the most effective climate solution. Also, if we acknowledge nuclear's market collapse and help developing countries harness more modern options for reliable and affordable energy, that would help smoke out nuclear weapons proliferators and help to end energy poverty. Now, if you combine the electricity and the oil revolutions that I've summarized, plus similar opportunities with natural gas and directly used coal, then you have the really big story, reinventing fire. And at Rocky Mountain Institute, we are focused on driving this business-led transition from oil and coal to efficiency and renewables. I suspect the shortest path is probably just to let all ways to save or produce energy compete fairly at honest prices, regardless of their type, technology, size, location, or ownership. Gee, I wonder who wouldn't be in favor of that. Why don't we find out? Just by taking economics seriously. Now, what I've just summarized rests on very detailed practical experience and empirical evidence. I think it reflects where the smarter energy companies are headed in their coevolution with civil society, with a few governments helping, while most struggle to catch up or even stand in the way. There is still much old thinking out there. As Oilman Murray Strong remarked, not all the fossils are in the fuel. But If you think anything I've said sounds too good to be true, just remember that nice remark by Marshall McLuhan, who said, "Only puny secrets need protection. Big discoveries are protected by public incredulity." Thank you very much. We have some time for Q&A. There are two microphones that will circulate, and when one gets to you, please identify yourself and ask a brief question. Back there, please.
Excuse me. Great talk, Amory. Andy Revkin, New York Times and Pace University.
Welcome.
We had a recent email conversation about the rusty oil tanks in my basement when I had to replace our heating tanks, because there was no easy route for me to, as a consumer, and even me, you know, I write about energy and climate, and have done so for 20 years, to figure out whether it would pay to do geothermal with a longer, to invest, to take out a loan. And so it's not just public incredulity, but it's public inertia. And what could be done to move this conversation forward with real traction in places that matter? Like, I'm assuming here in Colorado, a lot of people use heating oil as well to heat their houses. So how do you kind of build in the messaging beyond the Pentagon, who are willing to, do consultancy studies and stuff and get consumers to really change habits?
Well, if, of course, you reward utilities for cutting your bill, not selling you more energy, they will become enthusiastic about being partners in this. They already have the knowledge and the customer relationships. There are exciting innovations in finance that could finance the retrofit of your house and every other house in the country. PACE bonds, as in PACENow.org, which are currently held up by some skullduggery at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and I'm hoping that will be resolved shortly, because this method of financing is actually very much in the interests of mortgage holders. The information is not the only problem, though. It's also lack of widely available skills. And there is some pretty rapid retraining starting to go on using the stimulus money, because this administration has put a high priority on weatherizing houses like yours or like mine, because in 40 minutes our house will get its next blower door test to see if we have actually succeeded in caulking the hidden leaks that turned out to be all over our greenhouse glazing because some gaskets had shrunk over the last 28 years. Nobody's immune from needing this stuff, but, I happen to have that kind of knowledge. I have 90 colleagues at RMI, many of whom are experts in this stuff, and that is not common around the country. We need more efforts like that in civil society as well as in government. We need better availability of capital for small business, because there are a lot of entrepreneurs who are good at this stuff and starve for capital. It's very much intertwined with our economic recovery all over the country, with jobs well distributed by occupation and location. But I think each of us has an important part to play in this solution, because our energy use is made of millions of little pieces caused by millions of little choices, and the solutions are exactly the same thing. They're just better choices coming from better information. I think your newspaper can play an important part there, too. There was one down in the front here, and one here, whichever gets there first. Sir, wait for the mic, please.
During your talk, my name is Raymond Learzy. During your talk, you referred to nuclear energy causing climatic chaos and nuclear bombs.
It was the coal plants that caused climate chaos and the nuclear that spread nuclear bombs.
Okay.
One of each.
And could you maybe touch upon the possibility of natural gas plants replacing coal plants? Because we've had such an expanded... our resources in natural gas have grown dramatically over the last 5 years, and I think causing us to review natural gas in a totally different way.
Yes. Just last week, MIT published a very good report on the new natural gas landscape, and there is now a 650-odd trillion cubic foot reserve of shale gas that was counted at zero a few years ago because we didn't yet have the technology proven out. There are still some questions about water use and contamination that it appears can be solved with good practice and are being solved with good practice. Not everybody uses good practice. The regulatory situation is in flux, but without doubt, we have a lot more and cheaper gas than we thought we did even a few years ago. And in the Aspen Energy Forum last week, some of the best experts in electricity were telling us from their different perspectives that yes, indeed, if you just look at the forward price curves in the market, it's cheaper to run a combined cycle gas plant than to run a coal plant if they both already exist, and the market's starting to flip in that way. And coal is losing dramatically in market share to gas for that reason. Of course, I would like to see both lose to efficiency and renewables, and that is starting to happen as well because they're even cheaper. But again, as long as we reward the opposite of what we want, as long as we reward utilities for selling more energy and penalize them for cutting your bill, it's hard for them to do the best thing for the customer because they're hurting their own financial prospects. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Hi, my name is Paul Benton. So the good news is that there are solutions, and this is very encouraging. Others have argued that the bad news is that it will take too long to apply these solutions to make a difference, that once you factor in the effect of China and India, the so-called tipping point that we hit in 2050 will be blown by, and we will face the environmental catastrophe despite the solutions at hand. So I have two questions. Is the tipping point of 2050 real, and what is the timeline that you foresee with the presentation you made this morning? And secondly, I wonder if you could comment on the work that Nathan Meibold is making over at Intellectual Ventures in Washington. As reported in the book Super Freakonomics, apparently there is a way of buying more time by, loosely speaking, seeding the clouds, as it were, the stratosphere, and cooling the earth by pumping about 20 gallons a minute of sulfur dioxide. Nathan Meibold was Bill Gates' CTO at Microsoft, and so the question is, do we have enough time, and is what I just described quackery or reality?
The late Dana Meadows was once asked, do we have enough time, and she correctly answered, we have exactly enough time starting now. Or as designer Bill McDonough says, negligence begins tomorrow, because now we know what to do. We'll know better around the middle of next year when my team has published Reinventing Fire, but a great deal is known now, and you can see that from what's happening in the market. Notice that this is global. This includes China, India, and everybody else. And Tom Friedman has written compellingly, as have some in the New York Times and elsewhere, about the extraordinary energy shift going on in China, whose fossil fuel share of power generation actually went down 1.5 percentage points last year. China has been retiring its least efficient coal plants very rapidly, 40-odd gigawatts lately, 26 gigawatts more this year and next year. And the share of what they're installing is shifting so dramatically that they've cut in half in 3 years the amount of net new coal capacity they're installing. Now, coal and big hydro and nuclear are the three big old bureaucracies with the Russian-trained Lipunk-style engineers. But as those folks retire, there's a generational change accentuated by more open decision-making and more wholesale price competition. And all of those things bode ill for the big central plants that are starting to fade a bit in China, just as they are in the rest of the world. India, I would say, is about 10 years behind China, but starting to catch up. And as they take economics more seriously, as they discover what stuff really costs, I think the same thing will happen. Bear in mind that China is no longer just a centrally planned economy. one of the top entrepreneurs was telling us a couple of months ago that in China last year, 60% of the GDP, 70% of the net earnings, and 80% of the new jobs come from private enterprise. And that's what's driving their new energy economy, just as it is in our country. Orville Schell, a few years ago, asked me to do the concluding talk to a U.S.-China climate summit, and I rather startled our Chinese guests by addressing him in this way. Your society's 5 millennia older than mine. Your country has 5 times as many brains as mine, quite possibly better ones. 90% or so of the technologies that underlay the Western Industrial Revolution were invented in China. You have the only country that's cut energy intensity over 5% a year for a quarter century. And yeah, you fell off the rails in 2002, but you're getting back on. You have the only country to have energy efficiency as its top priority for national development. It's at the core of the 11th five-year plan. By the way, it'll be stronger in the 12th one about to come out. Not because some treaty made you do it, but because people like Wang Zhibao understand that otherwise China cannot afford to develop because the supply side eats the budget. I would say now your coal plants are more efficient on average than ours, and you're ahead of us in ultra-high voltage transmission. I could and did say then, your cars are more efficient than ours and you have stricter standards for them. Of course, there are formidable obstacles to the efficiency and renewables emphasis that you're setting, or to anything else, and especially in the provinces, heaven is high and the emperor is far away. But after all, remember this is 3 years ago, you do have more capable paramount leaders than we do, you work harder, and you're more highly motivated. So for all these reasons, I think we can rely on China to lead the world out of the climate mess. And I sat down, and once they got over their shock at not being patronized, they rather liked this idea. And it is the approach of respectful engagement that this administration has been using, not only through diplomacy, but through Steve Chu, Energy Secretary, who is, of course, Chinese-American, much admired there. And it was a brilliant appointment, partly for that reason. And it's working very well. So I'm quite encouraged by how that's going, and the issue is whether we're going to catch up with China, not the other way around.
Can you also mention
Bible? Oh, I'm sorry. Well, Nathan's a very bright guy. I think all these forms of geoengineering are very scary because we don't really know what we're doing, or as, Wendell Berry, I think. No, somebody or other said, we don't know what we're doing because we don't know what we're undoing. We got in this mess by being quite arrogant about how much we know about climate science, and I don't think we'll get out of it by making the same assumption. But we do have very clear solutions that are very fast if deployed sensibly, and I would like him to put his considerable horsepower into that effort. And I think that is indeed happening as well. And Bill Gates is one of the industrial leaders who came out with an excellent report recently on energy innovation and is trying to get really serious commitment to that. We are woefully underinvesting in it at all levels. Sir.
Hi, my name's Len Foreman. At the end of the day, this is all about changing behavior and the incentives behind it, and you talked about business, but much of the advancement is going to take place at the regulatory level, at the local level. What's happening there to change the economic incentives around?
Well, it doesn't get more local than my local electric co-op, and the chairman, Hal Clark, is sitting right here and leading that charge. In both Holy Cross Electric, our co-op, and the Aspen Muni, we have, last I heard, the highest renewable fraction of any of those kinds of utilities in the country. Nationwide, it's a very mixed picture, and we have a considerable graying and sort of ossification of utility commission staffs because there wasn't a good mechanism for intake of smart young engineers and economists working their way up in most states. So the old thinking is more embedded at the PUC staff level in most states than in the marketplace. There are reforming commissioners trying to do the right thing in many states. Some states haven't got the message yet. And, of course, we have a terrible mess. We have 3,000-odd kinds of utilities, including somewhat under 200 big ones, private ones with 3/4 of the market. But we also have utility regulation in almost every state, except that in about half the states, they decided to cede their authority to Washington through what was called restructuring or deregulation, which it wasn't. And we're kind of in limbo between several competing models of where the industry ought to go. However, the good news is we have 50 labs to experiment in. I think that's good on balance. And we also have terrific leadership now with John Wellinghoff of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, who really gets this stuff. So it's starting to look a bit more encouraging, and I would urge all of you from wherever you are to pay careful attention to what your state Public Utility Commission, Public Service Commission, Corporation Commission is doing. That is the biggest leverage point in energy policy. And the most important thing we could do for saving electricity and gas is called decoupling and shared savings, which works fine in the dozen or so states that do it for electricity, about 20 for gas. There's about an equal number who are considering it. But if we can align utility and customer incentives, that will have a terrific effect and already has where it's been tried. I'll mention also one other public policy innovation that's vital for getting new cars on the road that are very efficient, and this could be done at a state or regional level. It's called feebates. It's a cross between a fee and a rebate. So you go to the dealer to get a new vehicle of the size you want, and there are more and less efficient models on offer, of which the less efficient ones pay a corresponding fee, which is used to pay a rebate when you buy the more efficient ones. So you widen the price spread within each size class enough so that buyers will pay attention to the life cycle fuel saving, not just the first year or two. And although some of us came up with this in the 70s, it wasn't really tried at scale until France did at the end of '07. In the first year, '08, sales of inefficient cars went down 42%. Sales of efficient cars went up 50%. A stunning result. In the next year, it got even stronger, even though the fuel prices went down. This is a very encouraging signal that indeed, as we expected, will work better and be more politically attractive than either gasoline taxes or efficiency standards. Way in the back. Thanks.
Just an FYI, the PACE program got killed yesterday.
Got what?
Killed. It's dead.
No.
Yeah. Matt Golden just sent something over yesterday. He said that Obama couldn't save it, and it's out, and it'll take a full act of Congress to bring it back. So.
There's a lot more going on than that behind the scenes.
All right. The second question is, a lot of this seems predicated...
And bear in mind, by the way, that if this were true, we could no longer build sidewalks, sewers, or other infrastructure which use exactly the same mechanism.
My understanding is that Freddie and Fannie are objecting to this assessment getting ahead of them for some reason.
It's a very simple problem. They have no understanding or analytic capability in energy efficiency and don't realize that...
I'm not suggesting they do. I'm simply reporting on what I saw in the news yesterday.
Yeah, I don't think it was correctly reported, but thank you.
All righty. So your premise here seems largely predicated on widespread retrofit, change, redesign, redevelopment of an existing infrastructure. Mm-hmm. That seems wildly unrealistic. You're suggesting that all of our existing buildings, if they are using 70% of our energy, are going to make a capital investment, and more importantly, that they have the interest. And generally speaking, the U.S. population is largely uninterested in the subject of energy efficiency. So these are, yes, I agree, efficiency could do a great deal, but how exactly do you propose that any of this actually take place?
What I've summarized here is the kind of grand synthesis of efficiency and renewables transition from fossil fuel. However, behind that, we have a half dozen operating or implementing initiatives at RMI which are answering exactly that question. There's one in deep retrofit of commercial buildings, another in new production housing, another in vehicles, especially fleet vehicles, another in industrial redesign, another in next generation utilities, and so on. And in each case, we're gaining a detailed and exact understanding of what needs to change, where, and what needs to happen for that to happen, and what needs to happen for that to happen, and figuring out what we can do with unique advantage and what others need to do that we can catalyze. Several of those are already well underway, and of course we've been doing work of this sort for many years. It's hard to give a short answer because these fields are very complex. Just the commercial real estate value chain has about 24 players, each with stunning perfection, rewarded for inefficiency and penalized for efficiency. But we think we are finding some very important leverage points that can be successfully exploited and already are being. Bear in mind that if you have a commercial building of any kind that's inefficient, you are foregoing a lot of benefits. If it were efficient, you'd have more happy, healthy, and productive people in it. You could collect higher rent. You would get faster absorption, better tenant retention, better residual value. And the real estate developers we work with are finding this to be true. And the ones we particularly like to work with, like Tony Malkin, his family owns the Empire State Building, can be quite in your face about it. He will go up to other competitive developers at a party and say, "Hi, I made more money than you did last year. Let me tell you how." It's called energy efficiency and integrative design. He does tend to get their attention. And there are major players in property management, in finance, in energy service companies, and so on, that can affect very large fleets of building at once. So we're looking for exactly those opportunities for amplification that goes to scale rapidly. Yes.
Hi there, Sandra Familet. You obviously, entrepreneurs are starved for capital. So what I'd like to know is, which venture capital firms do you highly respect that you feel are really funding those future entrepreneurs and really making things happen in Washington, D.C.?
I don't think it would be tactful for me to answer that question, even if I knew the answer. there are quite a few of them in the room. And different firms have different strengths and weaknesses, but the VC sector and also angel investors, even more importantly at this time actually, have extraordinary opportunity. Any good big VC firm will probably have 10 or tens of energy things in its portfolio, any one of which could be a game changer, and it's pretty unlikely none of them will work. So I was giving kind of a business as usual scenario, but I think, in fact, many things are coming at us on the supply and demand side that will make it even easier than I describe, thanks to this unique entrepreneurial system in which America remains so strong. It's one of the few areas in which we do have a definite competitive advantage and need to make sure to keep it. Ma'am?
Thank you. I'm Ann Tate. Amory, you've been doing this for a long time, and you have managed to, throughout this period, had a consistently upbeat tone about how we can do this. Can you address how you feel about it now, and how that is justified now as opposed to 15 years ago when you were starting to do this, or do you think it's been a continual arc of improvement?
Well, nothing goes just in one direction, and as in the temporary Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac mess with PACE bonds, which will be solved one way or another, there are always setbacks and dark times along the road. But I am more sanguine than ever, given the pace and strength of the market activity in benign supply and efficient use, that we are finally getting on the right path for good. This is widely acknowledged, actually, among the smarter players in the fossil fuel industries, where I've also worked for about 37 years. At least three of the top five coal producers are valuing their assets through the lens of a hydrogen value chain that would put coal to its highest and best use, which is not combustion. The smarter oil companies realize it's a great industry and a bad business and have been trying to get out of it for quite a while. It's quite exciting times with one system dying and others struggling to be born. But I think the combination of motives is what will really put us over the top this time. What I mean by that is that the suggestions I made are actually very trans-ideological. Whether you most care about national security or jobs and profits and prosperity or climate and environment, you end up doing the same things anyway. So if we can do the unpolitical thing nowadays of concentrating on outcomes, not motives, a very broad consensus can be built. And in any case, the business case is so powerful that end runs around policy gridlock are quite feasible. I think there are some in our political system who understand the trans-ideological message now, and it is certainly welling up in civil society, most of all in the private sector. And I think I'd place my bets on this sort of thing continuing just because investors tend to flock to what has lower cost and lower risk. So that shift is well underway. I don't see it reversing, quite the contrary. Perhaps that's enough to get us started. Are we on a hard stop now, or how much? 10 more minutes. Terrific. The gentleman with two hands up back there, please.
Ha. Last year, the United States of America put in a lot more wind power than solar in terms of new installations. How do you think about the wisdom of that, and what do you see are the sort of simple pros and cons, solar versus wind in this country? Thank you.
Well, by conventional measures, wind power is a lot cheaper today than solar power. It's about new firmed wind, firm meaning you can get it any time you want, whether the wind's blowing at that moment or not, is coming in at about half the cost of new coal power or a third the cost of new nuclear power. And that's why so much of it is being built. Transmission has not always caught up. 17% of the wind power Texas could have produced last year got curtailed because it wasn't hooked up yet or utilities wouldn't take it at the time. And we still have utilities who are actually refusing wind power, even though it's cheaper than what they got, just because they don't like competition. FERC will ultimately solve this problem. Actually, China solved it in a much more interesting way. If you're a transmission company and you don't hook up a wind farm when it's built, you have to pay them twice the going rate until you get it hooked up. Maybe we should try that. solar power is also on a very rapid cost reduction curve, dropped 40 or 50% in cost last year due to a Chinese price war, but also due to genuine technical advances and scaling and maturation of manufacturing. There is still a great deal to be done in that direction. We just, a couple of weeks ago in San Jose, ran a charrette with industry on how to cut out close to two-thirds of the so-called balance of system cost for photovoltaics, that is everything other than the module. And it's pretty clear that there's a path to get below a dollar a watt on the installed whole system of photovoltaics. So one of our trustees, Tom Dinwoody, who helped start what is now SunPower, major photovoltaic firm, has a very interesting calculation that I think is directionally quite right. He says if in, say, New Jersey, an average solar climate, you start building a coal or gas or nuclear plant, and right next to it, you simultaneously start building a photovoltaic plant with the same annual output. By the time the thermal plant is finished, the photovoltaic plant, just riding the historic cost curve down, will be producing slightly cheaper electricity. It will produce about 2.5 times as much electricity as the other plant at peak because it works really well on hot afternoons when the electricity is worth the most. And you can now reproduce the solar plant every 20 months from the manufacturing capacity you just built. So if you had built the thermal plant instead, you would feel a lot of regret. Well, these two technologies are different in their characteristics. Fortunately, they like different kinds of weather patterns. You know, sunny, hot, flat calms are good for photovoltaics. Windier, stormier weather is good for wind. And that's part of the trick, that if you want reliable supply with a lot of these two variable kinds of renewables, then you diversify by type, you diversify by location, so they're seeing different weather at a given moment. You forecast them, it's called weather forecasting, we're quite good at it, and you integrate them with the demand side and supply side resources now on the grid. So we've been simulating how all those moving parts fit together, and it's actually looking pretty straightforward, that you just back down the fossil fuel plants whenever the wind blows or the sun shines, whatever's happening at the time, and you can get to very high renewable fractions without needing bulk storage just by doing what utilities have done for 100 and some years called economic dispatch. You run the plants that are cheapest to operate, and that's generally the renewable plants because they have no fuel. Sir? Here's the microphone.
Hi, Milton Sidley. They talk about the coal plants getting so clean. Could you comment on that a little bit?
Well, in general, it's propaganda. And indeed, there is a huge investment, hundreds of billions of dollars, to be made in cleaning up the existing coal plants, even to comply with the Clean Air Act, not to mention the Clean Water Act. So it's sort of, buddy, can you spare $1 trillion? There is, however, one interesting development that Shell did with the University of Eindhoven in Holland. It's a purely physical method of carbon separation that they were able to talk about starting a few months ago after they filed the patent applications. And for any techies in the crowd, the way it works is you suddenly decompress the flue gas with a turbo expander that's under precise closed-loop digital control to get to exactly the point on the CO2 phase diagram where the CO2 flies out as liquid droplets. Then you can mechanically cyclone it out, recompress the flue gas with a turbine on the same shaft, and send it on its way. Currently, they're figuring that in a power plant application, this would be about 10 times cheaper than trying to remove the CO2 by normal chemical methods, and very compact. You could put 1,000 megawatts of it in the corner of this room, so it should be retrofittable. They'll know that probably by the end of this year, because there is a retrofit experiment going on with the coal plant now. If that succeeds, it would cut the total cost of carbon capture and storage by roughly threefold, making it quite interesting for retrofit, particularly in China. It would not make a business case for building new coal plants anywhere. There isn't one. And it would not be as interesting in this country economically as all the other cheaper methods I just showed for getting off coal. In other words, back to this slide. It is, I think, a very important part of the toolkit, which we will all be watching attentively to see whether by the end of the year it is confirmed to have the promise that Shell currently believes it does. Sir.
Do you know if there's any tours around Aspen here of the super insulated houses or structures?
Yes. Actually, our own house has public tours every Friday at 2, and please sign up at rmi.org if you would like one. There are also sporadic tours, and who local can help me with this? There is a group that sponsors them of a number of efficient and solar buildings.
I think CORE is doing that, AspenCORE.org.
Aspen, C-O-R-E.
CORE in Carbondale.
C-O-R-E.
Yeah, and City of Aspen and Energy Star are doing a bunch of programs like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, we just had a big group of architects down a few weeks ago. One of the more important ways we can contribute to this locally is just to help local design professionals and installers understand how to do this stuff. I think we have to stop right now. Thank you all for your kind attention. And Jenny?
Amory Lovins will be signing Winning the Oil Endgame and Natural Capitalism in the lobby, and they're also for sale out there. Thank you.
And please make sure I get my carbon cap back.